I'm Carrie Kaufman. Today on The Morning Show, we're celebrating 170 years of Wisconsin with Matt Blessing. He is the administrator of library archives and collections at the Wisconsin Historical Society. Matt, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Carrie, and welcome to Wisconsin.
Thank you. We're also celebrating with you, our callers. We've had a couple of people actually tweet in this morning. We're going to read that in a moment. What moment in Wisconsin history do you think is worth highlighting? What is your own personal great moment in Wisconsin history? Is there a family connection somehow? My grandfather invented this, and nobody really knows that. What questions do you have about our great state? 1-800-642 1234. That's 800-642-1234. ideas@wpr.org is our email, or you could tweet us at WPR Mornings. So Matt, let's start here. We started as a state on May 29th, so that was last week, 1848. We're going to talk about that in a second, though, but let's talk about what created the landscape of what is Wisconsin. Maybe take us a few thousand years back to these glaciers.
Sure, you bet. I actually heard that you were traveling around the state the last couple of weeks, and so it's important that you get a sense of what created the topography. Boy, 100,000 years ago,
going way back
before statehood. 100,000 years ago, the Earth went through a cooling stage, and it was the start of the last major epoch of glaciation. So picture glaciers that were at least a mile thick. In some places in northern Wisconsin, geologists estimate 2 miles thick, and they completely transformed the landscape. And as they descended, and some of the glaciers went as far south as the state of Missouri. But in Wisconsin, they hit that big bowl created by Lake Superior and another where Lake Michigan is, and they started to cleave into 3 different glaciers.
Hmm.
And they covered every part of the state except the far southwestern corner of the state, which geologists call the Driftless Area. Never touched by the glaciers.
Interesting.
And then about 15,000 years ago, the climate started to warm up and the glaciers started to retreat. And as they started to retreat, there was an enormous earthen dam that was created on the south shore of our most popular state park, Devil's Lake. And that dam held back what was called Glacial Lake Wisconsin, shallow lake all the way from present day on the south city of Portage to Stevens Point in the central part of the state, and Toma all the way on the west. And that Glacial Lake Wisconsin was there for several thousand years. And then geologists estimate sometime about 12,000 years before Common Era, that glacial dam burst. And within a matter of 3 days, the entire lake drained. We call it the Great Flood. And there were boulders, 1,000, 2,000-pound boulders that were rattling around southwestern Wisconsin, the size, you know, as if they were marbles.
Right.
And that huge flood, again, a lake flooding within 3 days, created the Wisconsin Dells that so many people are familiar with.
Got it.
And
those boulders kind of still exist. Like, people will point out to me and say, that's a glacial boulder.
Right. They call it an erratic. When you see a boulder the size of a bedroom just standing out in the middle of a field, that was probably left. That was brought down from the Canadian Shield. So wherever you are in Wisconsin, if you look carefully, you can see basically the effect of continental glaciation in the eastern part of the state, where we have the southern and northern Kettle Moraine State Park. You have drumlins and moraines. In the northern part of the state, where we have 14,000 lakes, most of those are left over as basically pothole lakes from big chunks of the glaciers.
Potholes.
And then in the place in the Driftless Area, which is totally unique, southwestern Wisconsin, northeastern Iowa, the far southeastern corner of Minnesota that evaded the glaciers.
Take us in. We have three people who have written in so far, but first, take us to circa 1948. First, we were a territory, and then we became a state. Who was behind it? What was the territory like at that time?
Wisconsin, in terms of European-American settlement, begins after the War of 1812. And the first influx of permanent European-American settlers are coming from Vermont and New York State. Many of them were abolitionists. And then there's a second wave of Germans that begins to arrive after the failed German Revolution of 1848.
So did they come down through Sault Ste. Marie and through the Great Lake systems, or did they overland?
Well, it's a mix. There were folks from the Missouri, Western Tennessee area that came up the Mississippi River. There were lead miners who often came up from the St. Louis area, and they would often only summer in Wisconsin and then head back down the river.
Presaging all of the people in Chicago who only summer in Wisconsin. Go ahead.
Right. And then there were others. Of course, the Erie Canal had opened in the 1820s, and there were schooners on the Great Lakes. And so the settlers from Yankee land, from Massachusetts, Vermont, and New York, were coming over as early as the 1830s and the 1840s. But it's also really important to remember that Wisconsin had one of the most diverse American Indian populations. We still do today. We have more sovereign nations in Wisconsin than any state east of the Rocky Mountains.
And they were already here. They weren't moved here from somewhere else.
There's human settlement in Wisconsin going back all the way. I mean, there are archaeological excavations of mammoths and mastodons that demonstrate, with butcher marks, that demonstrate or document that there's human settlement in Wisconsin going back at least 13,000 years.
Sherry on Facebook writes, I love the diversity of the landscape from the lakes of the north to the cozy valleys of the southwest. I love Madison and its vibrance. I love Bayfield and its subtle beauty. And I even love the people when they're not too cranky. Thank you, Sherry. I think that could be said pretty much everybody. But that diversity was created by the geological aspect that we were talking about earlier. Madison, capital city. That Capitol building has been there for a long time. Take us through, how did this become the capital city?
Well, one of those early Yankees was a man named James Doty. He came from the New England states. And like a lot of men of his generation, he was a land speculator. They knew how to make money. They knew how to identify land that had value. And Doty arrived in Wisconsin in the 1820s. He traveled the state, and he bought up large tracts of land near present-day Fond du Lac and also Madison. Went to a territorial convention, was disappointed that Governor Dodge chose the little hamlet of Belmont in far southwestern Wisconsin as a temporary capital. The next year went back, and it was a cold, chilly night, and he had both beaver robes to give to his other delegates, and he also had paper lots. He had basically had Madison surveyed and gave free lots away, and he walked away from the territorial convention with Madison having been chosen as the state capital.
So he bribed them.
Yeah, yeah. Heck of a guy.
We are talking about the history of Madison, Wisconsin. I have one quick question of Wisconsin, actually. That statue on the top of the Capitol,
yes.
Where is she pointing?
She's pointing southeast toward Lake Monona.
We had our compasses out last night trying to
figure
out why. I guess that's my bigger question.
The lakes that we know today as Mendota, Monona, Kiganza, settlement came from, and the surveyors came from the south. So they were identified as first, second, third, fourth lake. And the isthmus that James Doty identified for a city is actually built on a glacial drumlin.
Oh.
And so the settlement came that way. The first streets around Madison were facing the direction that the Capitol is facing, King Street, down towards Lake Monona.
We are talking about all things Wisconsin this morning, and we want you to participate. 1-800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. You can also Facebook us. We will talk more in a few minutes about the history of the Capitol and our role in the Civil War. It's the Morning Show. It's the Morning Show. I'm Carrie Kaufman. We're sitting here talking about the history of Wisconsin with Matt Blessing from the Wisconsin Historical Society. We were just talking, Matt, about the state capitol. And Troy has a question about Milwaukee. Troy, welcome to the program.
Yes. Hello. Thank you. So I was told that in Milwaukee that the reason why when you cross the bridges for the rivers, that they go on an angle was because the earlier design of the city of Milwaukee was very segregated with a lot of the European settlement between, like, the Irish and the Germans, and they actually had those rivers on purpose, those dividers, and there was no bridges to cross to keep segregation.
So Milwaukee was purposely built to keep people apart from each other. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, good question, Troy. Milwaukee's really settled by three men, Solomon Juneau on the east side of the river, Byron Kilbourne on the west, and George Walker on the south side, allegedly known as the fattest man in Milwaukee, but that's probably a myth. And they all had their plans for small villages, nothing like the metropolitan Milwaukee that we know today. And so they each plotted the land in their respective sides of the rivers. And when it came time to actually build bridges, the streets were askew.
Ah.
And so that's the background.
So three villages that came together. I want to talk about the Civil War. Wisconsin has a rich history in the Civil War. We were a free state. And we fought on the side of the Union. Talk to us about that.
Sure. Well, maybe just for a little background, Wisconsin was a hotbed of abolitionism from the very start. There was a failed state constitutional convention. We were ready to enter the Union in 1846. And that first version of the state constitution would have enfranchised African Americans. It also would have given women property rights, which was revolutionary.
Wow.
At the time. That constitution failed. In 1848, they got back together and formed a more traditional form of government. But, of course, slavery was heating up as a national issue. And probably the most important abolitionist in Wisconsin history was a man named Sherman Booth. As a young man studying at Yale, he had taught imprisoned Africans from the Amistad slave ship who were imprisoned in New Haven how to read. And he got involved in the movement being the abolitionist movement. He came to Wisconsin in 1848, just about the time of statehood, and was a newspaper man, and he established the newspaper, the Wisconsin Freeman. We know it today as the Waukesha Freeman newspaper. A few years later, there was the Fugitive Slave Act requiring that property owners relinquished runaway slaves. It was very, very controversial in the northern half of the Union. And there was a case with a runaway slave by the name of Joshua Glover, who was captured in Racine, imprisoned temporarily in Milwaukee, and abolitionists rescued him. They actually tore down the walls of the jail and put him on the underground so that Glover could escape to Canada. And Sherman Booth is arrested for his role in the Joshua Glover case.
So
the state Supreme Court.
Yes.
Sorry, go ahead.
No,
Troy.
No, go ahead. The same.
Well, the state Supreme Court affirmed Sherman Booth's innocence on the case. It went to the U.S. Supreme Court, and he was convicted. He was ultimately pardoned by President Buchanan just before the Civil War broke out. But it was an incredibly divisive issue in Wisconsin all through the 1850s.
This was the same Supreme Court that later decided the Dred Scott case.
Exactly, exactly.
So they weren't really...
Roger Taney.
Roger Taney. They weren't really like abolitionists.
Correct.
But what's interesting here is what you're talking about is that there was a division. There were abolitionists here, but there were people who perhaps were for slavery or at least for not making trouble with the South.
There were slave owners in Wisconsin. Mm. There were members of the Federal Officer Corps at the federal forts at Prairie du Chien and at Portage who owned slaves. There were lead miners in the far southwestern quadrant of the state who owned slaves. So it was a divisive issue.
We are talking to Mac Blessing from the Historical Society about our great state, about the history of the state of Wisconsin. I'm going to talk about the present of the state of Wisconsin in a moment. Right now, we are finally in summer, Matt. It's June, and yesterday it seemed like it was March, so weather is getting a little warmer. Low to mid-70s in the north, upper 70s to low 80s in the south. Tomorrow is going to start out cold, especially along the lakeshore and along in northern Wisconsin, partly cloudy skies with a chance for rain and a few weak thunderstorms south of I-94 during the morning. But dry weather and sunny skies for the rest. Yay, we're getting into summer. So back to our state, how many people did we send to the Civil War? How did we get into the Civil War? How did we decide that we weren't going to sit this out?
Yeah, it's really hard in the 21st century to convey the magnitude of the Civil War. But keep in mind, Wisconsin only had a population of about 750,000 people at the time of Fort Sumter, the outbreak of the Civil War. Today we have a population of almost 6 million.
Wow.
90,000 men signed up for the Civil War. 12,000 died during the war, about two-thirds from disease, one-third on the battlefield. To put that in perspective for the equivalent of today's population, that's as if 700,000 Wisconsin residents signed up for the draft today, and the equivalent of about 92,000 deaths. So there's a whole generation in the 1870s, 1880s, Wisconsin's political leadership that are forged by the Civil War. Any community of any size in Wisconsin has a Civil War marker or a statue. The Historical Society has tracked more than 540 of them around the state.
You know, we think of Vietnam having lost lots of people in Vietnam. We think of World War I when people came back shell-shocked. It's hard to grasp the sheer numbers of people who died in the Civil War.
I once had a military history class many years ago. And I remember the professor saying that the American Civil War is the only war where you can say every single family had a connection. Every single family had a loss or knew someone. And that's not true in other wars, given, again, the severity. We're familiar with World War II and Vietnam War, which were serious, of course. But the Civil War... It had a legacy that's still with us to this day.
And we had troops on the Western Front, but we also had troops in the East fighting on the Mason-Dixon line.
Oh, absolutely. The Iron Brigade experienced the highest percentage of casualties of any unit in the war. They were at Antietam. They were at Shiloh. They were at Gettysburg.
We are talking with Matt Blessing from the Wisconsin Historical Society about all things Wisconsin. What do you love about our state? What is your favorite moment over the decades? Call us at 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. You can also go to our Facebook page. Brandy actually wrote on our Facebook page, "I love the multiculturalism of Southeast Wisconsin. There is so much to experience and to do." The multiculturalism, does that have to do with the geography of Southeast Wisconsin, or just kind of people coming from different states there?
I think it has. It's like I said, from the time of American Indian settlement thousands of years ago to the 19th century, where it's a polyglot of Western, Northern European populations, to today, especially in the southeastern portion of the state, where we have one of the largest Hmong populations in the country. We have Somalis. We have many Central American countries. It's an attractive place to live and work.
Mark from Fall Creek, welcome to the program, Mark.
Yeah, I have heard the history of my family regards to the Civil War, and family history is not always that reliable. But what I have heard is three things. First, that immigrants, from Europe were given citizenship in return for fighting in the Civil War, and that there was some kind of a draft, and that you could pay, I believe it was quite a large sum, if you paid $240.
Yeah, you're close. I think it's $300, which is about, multiply that times 20. That's about $6,000 in today's dollars.
You could buy your way out of the draft in
That's
the Civil
right.
War.
Right. It was quite common that you could put up $300 if you could scrounge together $300.
Right.
A lot of money at the time, but that was quite common.
And so I would assume that immigrants then were, I've heard that Irish people were drafted into the war who had just come over. I would assume that the people who didn't go fight in the Civil War were the people who had lots of money.
That was more common, right? If you were upper middle class, upper class, they were able to buy their way out. And there were folks who left the state. I mean, keep in mind that the Union settled huge amounts of the Western states. We built the Transcontinental Railroad, began building the Transcontinental Railroad during the war. So there were plenty of people that, why they left, we've lost
okay.
the rationale, but it very well could have been the war. And it was alluring to head west if you were trying to protect a son.
We are talking about Wisconsin history with Matt Blessing. Let's get to 1871. 1871 brought disaster to Wisconsin in the form of a fire, the Peshtigo Fire. Did it happen actually on the same day as the Chicago Fire, or just kind of similar to?
It did, and Chicago got all the news.
Wow.
But the Peshtigo Fire, October of 1871, is the deadliest wildfire in American history. And industrial logging had started after the Civil War. Increase Lapham had written about the impact of commercial logging and the devastation that it was about to bring to Wisconsin. He really forecast it. This is in the far, of course, northeast corner of Wisconsin, north of Green Bay, village of Peshtigo, a couple thousand people, prosperous, lumbering town. They had a wood implements factory. And there was all sorts of slash that was left by the lumber companies. And that year was a severe drought. Forest fires began in late September, and they were able to put them out. But then there was a monster fire that started that evening of October 8th. The heat was so intense that it generated its own wind. And the winds were carried at more than 100 miles per hour. So large swaths of Oconto, Marinette, it skipped over the Green Bay and portions of Kewaunee County were burned. More than 2,000 square miles, more than a million acres were burned. And we don't know.
And there was a lot of lumber because there was lumbering. There was a lot of fuel for this fire.
Right, exactly. Historians estimate at least 1,500 people died, but there were so many lumberjacks who were itinerant workers, the numbers could have been 2,500, 3,000 people. But again, it was the same night as the Chicago fire, which garnered so much attention.
Chicago steals the thunder once again. How did the Peshtigo fire change Wisconsin? We stopped lumbering there?
No, there were major fires for another 50 or 60 years. The lumber industry continued to march on. By the turn of the last century, by 1900, the first forester of the United States estimated that 92% of Wisconsin's original forests had been cut over. And every 5 or 6 years, there would be a drought and a major fire. And it's really not until the 19-teens and the 1920s that the Wisconsin Conservation Department and the federal U.S. Forest Service really begin to get a handle on forest fires, which was just a major concern for our great-grandparents' generation, the fear of fire, wildfire.
Mm-hmm. And farms began to take their place, and we discovered this rich Webster soil that we have from the glaciers.
Right. I mean, farming goes all the way back to the times of American Indians, and I have friends who are archaeologists who have found ancient American Indian gardens. The soil in the southern two-thirds of the state had a richer loam. In the late 19th, early 20th century, a lot of those lumber companies had cut over lands to sell. And that's really a sad chapter in Wisconsin history where this is the time of Eastern and Southern European immigration to Wisconsin. And a lot of those lands in far northern Wisconsin were sold to poor immigrants. The growing season, in most cases, was too short. And a lot of those farms failed, went into foreclosure in the 19-teens, 1920s, and really it's the beginning of a agricultural depression that lasted right up until World War II.
We're going to talk about stereotypical things about Wisconsin. We are known for beer, brats, and cheese. They may seem cliche, but there's craftsmanship here. When did that kind of, not just dirt farming, but dairy farming start?
Dairy farming starts out of a crisis. Wisconsin had been one of the country's leading wheat producers before the Civil War. After the war, western lands in Kansas and Nebraska begin to be plowed. And with the railroad network, and there was a wheat blight in Wisconsin, a little too much soil. Wet soil. And Wisconsin farmers were really struggling in the 1870s. But there's an invention in the 1870s that changes everything, and that's refrigerated railroad cars are invented in the East. And so that opens up the possibility for cheesemakers and the dairy revolution. And many of Wisconsin's early farmers had come from New York State, where there was a dairy and a cheesemaking tradition, and there were also Germans and Swiss who knew a lot about cheesemaking and the dairy industry. So it's not until the 1870s and the 1880s that dairy farming begins to get traction. And then there are university professors here at the University of Wisconsin who are innovative and introducing new concepts.
We are talking about the history of Wisconsin with Matt Blessing from the Wisconsin Historical Society. We're going to talk about more recent events in Wisconsin history and take your calls, 800-642-1234. When we come back in a moment, you can also email us at ideas@wpr.org or tweet WPR Mornings. It is the morning show. Right now, Matt, let's get into the Buc-ee's. if anybody has been around Dane County in the last few weeks, and if you're planning to visit the Capitol, you will see that there are Buc-ee statues, Buc-ee the Badger statues, yep, that artists have painted. And I have to tell you this story. I've been walking around with a friend who is not a sports person, so who has not necessarily seen this mascot around. And she turns to me in the middle of the day and says, "What's with the cats?" And I said, "They're not cats, they're badgers." And she was like, "They look like cats."
Yeah.
And then we were at a place where there was a Buc-ee the Badger, and yeah, right across that coffee shop we were at, there was a bronze statue of an actual badger with her pups. And she walked up to that and said, "That's a badger," which doesn't look anything like Buc-ee. So how did we get this kind of cartoonish, wide-faced badger as our mascot?
Well, I don't know about the actual creation of the University of Wisconsin's Badger, which is copyrighted, and even the nickname Badger is open to historical interpretation. There is, of course, the animal. For many years, historians would make the case, and was taught by school teachers, that badgers were those early southwestern lead miners who dug a hole in the ground that first winter. That's open to contention. There is a historian out of UW-Milwaukee who kind of looked at the etymology of the word badger, which sort of means a rascal in England in the early 19th century. So it's all open to interpretation. That's the joy of history.
So they may very well be cats. They may have been
No, I don't think they're cats. I can say that definitively.
Let's talk about one of the things that this state is known for is Milwaukee Summerfest.
Yes.
People come from all over the Midwest to go to Summerfest. Talk to me about how that started, how that got to be such a huge thing.
You know, it's a great story. The terrific Milwaukee-based historian John Goerda has written a lot in recent years about water and Milwaukee's relationship with Lake Michigan. And for many decades, Milwaukeeans turned their backs to the lake. It was cold. It was industrial. It wasn't beaches until the 1920s and the 1930s, when the Milwaukee socialists built the beaches.
But by the
1960s, Henry Meyer had visited Germany and seen the festivals, the beer festivals in Germany. And he came back, as longtime mayor of Milwaukee, came back and proposed the idea of Summerfest. And the first one was held in 1967 as a music festival, and it's grown and grown, hundreds of thousands of people. Milwaukee is the most frequently visited city in the important tourist trade. And then what I find very interesting, again, looping back to diversity, in the 1970s and the 1980s on the Summerfest grounds, all through the summer and the fall, are ethnic festivals, Irish Fest, German Fest, the list goes on and on. Indian Summer, recognizing and celebrating Wisconsin's American Indian cultural traditions. And there's hardly a weekend that goes by where there aren't 150,000 people at the Summerfest grounds. And it really is a celebration of a great location on a great lake.
So another thing that Wisconsin is known for all over the country is football. Yeah. This football team actually started a long time ago.
Yeah. No disrespect to my high school classmate, Paul Christ, and the UW Badgers, but really the passion for the Green Bay Packers goes way back as a statewide team. And it was the summer of 1919 that some Green Bay Meatpackers got together. And there, in 1919, this was a small business, the whole proposition of a professional football team. And there were small communities all over the Lake States that tried their hand at sponsoring professional football.
Mm-hmm.
The Packers were lucky. They were able to meet payroll and get through some lean years. And here we are almost 100 years later.
Right.
And it's a billion-dollar industry.
And they can still make payroll.
Right. And it's often the lead story on most, you know, local television news broadcasts.
Absolutely.
What's happening in Packer world.
Absolutely. Right. In 1919 also is when women got the right to vote. And
yeah.
Wisconsin was at the forefront of that, too.
Yeah, definitely. In June of 1919, Wisconsin became the first state to ratify the Constitution's 19th Amendment. And these were women like Ada James and Olympia Brown, whose mothers had been involved in the women's suffrage movement as early as the 1870s and the 1880s. For 50 years, they'd been working on getting women the right to vote. So it was part of the long arc in American history toward equality. So two important things happened in the summer of 1919.
Mm-hmm.
Women's suffrage and the creation of the Green Bay Packers. So welcome to Wisconsin, Carrie.
I like both of them, actually. I want to talk about the man who had probably a century of influence over Wisconsin, and that would be Bob La Follette. He was the governor. He was the senator. You mentioned the socialist started the beaches. He was a Republican socialist in the early 1900s. His sons also led the state.
Yep.
Talk to me about his influence over Wisconsin.
Yeah, just to back up, I would call La Follette's a progressive. The Republican Party dominates Wisconsin politics from the Civil War, really right up until the late 1940s. But within the Republican Party, there are the La Follette progressives, and there are the conservative stalwarts. And Bob La Follette gets his start as a district attorney, one term in Congress, governor of Wisconsin, and then U.S. senator. And it's a very, very interesting time that we call the Progressive Era. They didn't really refer to it at the time as much as the Progressive. It's just a label
mm-hmm.
that historians slap on it. And it's a time when there's a new university president by the name of Charles Van Hise. And Van Hise and La Follette share a vision called the Wisconsin Idea. And this is, of course, really important for Wisconsin Public Radio, that Van Hise is all about the university's talents and resources are the resources of the entire state. That encompasses the Wisconsin Idea. And La Follette is using the university as a laboratory for democracy. And there's this interchange between the policymakers in the state capitol and the professoriate at the University of Wisconsin. And 10 years later, with a little invention called radio, it's the beginning.
Which was
9XM
invented here.
Right
just,
here.
Right, right.
The first license in the country in 1922. There's that tie-in. So as early as the 1920s and the 1930s, you have people like the great Aldo Leopold sitting where I'm sitting, speaking into a microphone, educating farmers, and Stephen Babcock, and the list goes on and on of using the university to support the general population of Wisconsin.
The Wisconsin Idea, is it mostly about education?
It's education, it's farming, it's the economy, it's you name it, given the scale of a university, a world-class university like Wisconsin, there are people and there are talents that can be utilized to address society's issues.
And how much influence did it have, not just on our state, but beyond our state?
Well, in a case, one of the first institutions created, a man by the name of Charles McCarthy, who coined the phrase the Wisconsin idea, establishes the Wisconsin Legislative Reference Bureau, basically to conduct research for state legislators in a nonpartisan way. And that Legislative Reference Bureau gets copied by states across the United States as a way to create effective public policy based on their state's needs and issues.
I just want to touch, we've got a couple of minutes here. Wisconsin also brought us Earth Day. That actually happened here. That started here in Wisconsin in 1970.
Senator Gaylord Nelson, who had been a governor of Wisconsin in the early 1960s, looked at what was happening in the anti-Vietnam War movement and wanted to have a teach-in, not about the war, but about the environment. And so it was his idea. The first one was coordinated and sponsored on April 22nd, 1970. So we just celebrated our Earth Day.
Right.
And Gaylord Nelson, who comes out of the small community of Clear Lake, Wisconsin, and was the author of the Clean Water Act and one of the sponsors of the Environmental Protection Act, Earth Day begins here in Wisconsin.
We have been talking about all things Wisconsin today with Matt Blessing. Is there a favorite thing that you have about Wisconsin that you kind of at dinner parties regale people with that they don't know?
Oh, people call me the Cliff Clavin of Wisconsin, the factoids. That's a cultural reference point to the old Cheers.
Cheers culture.
So it's hard to identify one thing. I'm just increasingly intrigued by how Hollywood portrays Wisconsin, and we could have a whole show on that, whether it be Fonzie or that 70s show or a Matt Damon movie.
That is actually a really good idea to have a whole show. We've been talking to Matt Blessing, who is the administrator of library archives and collections at the Wisconsin Historical Society. It's been great fun talking to you, Matt. Thank you for coming here.
All right, thanks. Welcome.
Next up, do you know that there's a governor's race next year? Well, 10 Democratic candidates are vying for the nomination, and we will talk about it here on the Ideas Network.